the New York City Council. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Accepting applications for our paid year-long news production fellowship. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
This is KBOO Portland. It is 5 o'clock, and coming up next, we have KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Engineering Committee will meet on the first Wednesday at 7 p.m.
Hi, I'm Eileen with the Oregon Cultural Trust. Community radio means access to music, news, and programming for everyone. That's why I support KBOO with my contribution every year. It's also why I match that gift to the Oregon Cultural Trust. When you make a gift to KBOO, make a matching gift to the Cultural Trust by December 31st. Then you can use the cultural tax credit next year to reduce your state tax bill. It's true, and it's also how KBOO supporters guarantee access to cultural programming in Portland and all around the state. Visit culturaltrust.org today to learn more before December 31st.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, here in Oregon, the new year means new laws taking effect.
The philanthropic volunteer organization 99 Girlfriends is awarding two $100,000 grants and four smaller ones.
Fossil fuel companies have spent more than $180 billion on the creation of facilities that could create a 40% rise in plastic production over the next decade.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, December 27th, 2017. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Aaron J. Bernard. With this year's Christmas past, KBOO News poet Dan Raphael is wondering about future Christmases.
How many days old was Jesus when he became a refugee, fleeing to Egypt? No passport, no border guards, no walls. His home country occupied by those who would later engineer his death. To someone born this Christmas, the American 60s, the Great Barrier Reef, the Amazon rainforest will be as mythical as Hanuman, Camelot, or Middle Earth, stories their smartphones will tell them before they go to sleep, with visions of a clean green world dancing in their heads. At least that minority of children born with roofs and beds, able to grow up in the country of their birth, able to play outside without disease or danger. I'm dreaming of a safe world, a just world, a full-bellied world, a world where Christmas is just a little better and brighter than most other days. You might say I'm a dreamer, but there's millions of us. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
Here in Oregon, the new year means new laws taking effect. Drivers will feel the change with a 4% increase in the state gas tax and significant increases in vehicle registration and titling fees. The money will be used for road and infrastructure improvement. A provision of House Bill 3391, known as the Reproductive Health Equity Act, will allow Oregon residents living in the county, in the country illegally, to obtain a no-cost abortion at taxpayer expense. The bill also provides women across access to other reproductive health care services with no out-of-pocket costs. Senate Bill 719 will allow Oregon judges to issue extreme risk protection orders to take firearms away from people determined to pose an immediate threat to themselves or to family members. In 2018, nearly all beverage bottles will require a deposit, including coffee, tea, hard cider, fruit juice, and kombucha. Still exempt from the deposits are bottles of wine and distilled spirits, milks, and infant formula. Tobacco smokers face between 18 and 21 may want to stock up, as the legal age for tobacco purchases is rising to 21 on January 1st.
Portland city officials have agreed to appear before a federal judge within the next 60 days to discuss the Portland Department of Justice settlement agreement on police reform. The settlement came after a 2012 investigation that showed the Portland Police Bureau used excessive force when dealing with people who suffer from mental illness. Topics of touching base will include changes in force report policy, a new citizen oversight review board, new methods of discipline when an officer receives a complaint, and various other PPB controversies. The last time Portland city officials attended a DOJ settlement hearing in front of a federal court was last year.
The devastating GOP tax overhaul that passed last week by Republican Congress benefits the usual crowd of corporations, private institutions, including schools, and millionaires. But Oregon's local beer industry will also benefit from the tax bill. The GOP tax bill holds over $4 billion in tax breaks for the nation's small brewers because it tears the excise tax in half from about $7 a barrel to $3.50 per barrel for the first 60,000 barrels of beer brewed by companies that push product, adding up to less than 2 million barrels a year. Oregon has about 230 craft breweries who could be saving at least $210,000 in taxes within the forthcoming year. According to the Willamette Week, Art Lawrence, owner of Cascade Brewing in Beaverton and co-founder of the Oregon Small Brewers Coalition, a lobbying group for craft brewers, says the Brewers Association and other beer advocate groups have been working for over 5 years to pass this legislation. He elaborated, saying, "It has taken President Trump to recognize the importance of small business to Americans. This administration chose to expedite this much-talked-about boost to those taking a risk to achieve their dreams."
When times are tough, it's good to have friends. For many Oregonians in need, it's good to have 99 girlfriends. Now in its second year, this philanthropic volunteer organization has grown to include 253 women, each of whom contributes $1,100 per year. This year, the group is awarding two $100,000 grants and four smaller ones. One of the large grant recipients, Portland Homeless Family Solutions, focuses on helping families meet unexpected expenses so they can stay in their current residences. The other recipient, Urban Gleaners, started as a bootstrap operation but now distributes 31 tons of food to hungry children and families every month. 99 Girlfriends' goal for next year is 330 members and $363,000 to give away.
14-season Oregon Shakespeare Festival actor Gregory Valmont Thomas passed away this December 18th in Ashland after a battle with cancer. OSF's 2018 season will be dedicated to him under his working name G. Valmont Thomas. Those who knew him called him G-Val. OSF Artistic Director Bill Roush said G-Val passed away surrounded by many of the family and friends who've taken such good care of him during his illness. "I'm filled with gratitude to those who know this man so great of artistry and so generous of spirit." Indeed, of his last acts, to make a donation to OSF's Rex Raybould Fund in order to pay back the company for the care and help he received from so many. G. Valmont Thomas was the only OSF actor to have played Sir John Falstaff in all three Shakespeare plays that feature the character. His first roles with the festival were back in 1998, when he played Francis Flute in A Midsummer Night's Dream and Snake in The School of Scandal. Thomas performed approximately 60 roles in his 14 years at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. He will be missed.
And now it's time for your weekly point puzzle.
It's time for the puzzle.
Last week, I gave you a puzzle inspired by the National Museum of Math. Your eccentric uncle only buys presents whose price is a prime number. This year, he decides to buy enough presents so the prices contain every digit, 1 to 9, exactly once. He wants to spend as little as possible. How many gifts does he buy, and how much is his total? Well, the answer is that he buys 6 gifts, and his total is $207. There are a couple of different ways to reach this that vary by switching the units digits. One is 2, 3, 5, 41, 67, and 89. Our winner this week is Mike Fisher, who listens to KPOV in Bend, Oregon.
I'll be the gift of gab. The man with the given gift of gab.
For the new puzzle, I have a 2-week challenge for the new year. I'm looking for 3 classic works of literature whose names contain numbers. Add those 3 numbers together, and you will get 2018. So again, I'm looking for three classics whose titles contain numbers. Add those numbers together and you will get 2018. Send your name, your answer, and the station on which you hear the puzzle to puzzle@kpov.org by January 6th, and I'll select one winner from among any correct answers.
Every day, every day, every day, every day I write the puzzle.
This has been Pearl Stark with your Point Puzzle for the week of December 25th. The Point Puzzle is produced at KPOV, High Desert Community Radio.
Taking calcium and vitamin D supplements may not actually lower fracture risks for elder adults living independently. This according to a new study in the Journal of American Medical Association. The researchers looked at more than 50,000 participants from 33 clinical trials. They concluded that there was no significant difference in the risk of hip fractures for those who used calcium supplements, vitamin D supplements, or both, compared to those who took a placebo or no supplements at all. The chances of breaking a hip increase with age, and approximately 95% of hip fractures are caused by falling sideways, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. To prevent hip fractures, the CDC recommends screening for osteoporosis, doing strength and balance exercises, and getting eye exams. It also promotes steps to make the home safer, including getting rid of things one could trip over, putting railing on both sides of stairs, and providing sufficient light.
A lottery drawing to settle a tied Virginia legislative race has been indefinitely postponed, state election officials said on Tuesday, after the Democratic candidate mounted a legal fight. The Democratic candidate, Shelley Simon, seemed to win the recount of the ballots by one vote. However, a three-judge panel ruled that a disputed ballot should be counted for the Republican, David Yancey. That decision left the two candidates tied with 11,608 votes each in a district that includes the city of Newport News in southeastern Virginia. The lottery outcome could shift the statehouse balance of power. If the Democratic candidate were to win, the Republicans would lose control of the 100-member House of Delegates. The result would be an even 50-50 split with the Democrats, forcing the two parties into a power-sharing arrangement. The decision to put off the high-stakes lottery is just the latest twist in a dramatic election where the prize, determined by a coin toss, is control of the state legislature.
With more oil being pumped from the ground and consumption decreasing, what will the oil companies do? Drill less or lower prices? Nope, they'll make plastics. Fossil fuel companies, including Exxon and Shell, have spent more than $180 billion on the creation of facilities that could create a 40% rise in plastic production over the next decade. Plans and protests are still pending for the world's largest gas-to-methanol plant in Kalama, Washington. The methanol would be shipped to China to make plastic. A study released earlier this month by the Center for International Environmental Law showed that the plastics industry has known its products were polluting the world's oceans since the 1970s and has spent decades fighting regulations to keep the crisis from getting worse. In the last decade, more plastic was produced than during the entire 20th century.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
With National Native News, I'm Art Hughes, in for Antonia Gonzalez. Four Nebraska beer stores that closed last spring are fighting a state assessment that they owe hundreds of thousands of dollars in underreported state taxes and fees. The Lincoln Journal-Star reports the four stores that once operated on the edge of the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation dispute the State Department of Revenue claim that they owe a combined $600,000 in unpaid taxes over 3 years. It's the latest setback for the stores that once operated in the tiny town of White Clay, Nebraska, but were forced to close after concerns they fueled problems for the reservation where alcohol is banned. Physical activity is often included in Native stories and ceremonies. Today, health experts say sedentary ways are contributing to high rates of obesity and diabetes in Indian country. Some fitness experts and enthusiasts are working to bring resources and support to help Native people with their health concerns. This week, we are highlighting our USC Annenberg Center for Health Journalism series, and today we look at two border towns in the Southwest to explore some grassroots efforts.
Always make sure you get a nice warm-up first.
Pax Harvey explains some exercises as he belts out reps in a gym located in the reservation border town of Gallup, New Mexico. The advocate, comedian, and business development specialist says he uses fitness as a way to heal from trauma and handle everyday stresses. The Navajo powerlifting competitor mentors others by encouraging them to make positive choices, saying he was once immersed in negativity.
A lot of violence, drugs, and alcohol was very heavy. I was 9 years old when my dad took his life.
Harvey says he never sugarcoats the dysfunction of his childhood. Weightlifting became an outlet for his struggles with pain, frustration, and anger.
About 2 years ago, I became a powerlifting champion, World Cup champion, and national champion. And I started to help individuals and people that step into the weight room.
Some research suggests that people who believe they can lose weight are more likely to find success. Having role models may be a key component in building that confidence, says Brenda Charlie. She's a fitness coach in the city of Flagstaff, Arizona, more than 180 miles west of Gallup. Charlie has a degree in physical education, but says her interest in exercise started at a young age.
I grew up watching my parents. They were runners and they liked to ride their cycles all the time. I grew up with my parents modeling exercise.
Charlie, who's Navajo, works in both tribal communities and in Flagstaff at the Wellness Center run by Native Americans for Community Action, and says a fitness community with professionals can offer encouragement, obtainable goals, and knowledge. Didi Koya Koptiwa, who's Hopi, is among those who say they found community support at the Wellness Center.
I came from a family with diabetes, and of course, I'm right there if I don't take care of myself.
So she's going to kind of lead us.
Back in Gallup, Pax Harvey and a group of friends do bodyweight exercises. His fitness community stretches across Indian country as he makes time for the gym when traveling for work.
Whatever you learn in a weight room doesn't just apply in a weight room. It can also apply outside in the real world.
Changing the health of Native communities will take more than just grassroots and individual efforts, says Dr. John Molina. He's with Native Health in Phoenix and has worked with Indian Health Service clinics in Alaska and urban health centers in Arizona.
We cannot work in silos anymore. I think if we're going to really improve the health care of our people, we have to come together as a community of entities who provide health care for our people. So grassroots efforts that take place to improve our health, either through eating or exercise or activity, they really need to connect with these other entities, tribal and urban and IHS facilities, to say, how can we work together?
According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, consistency, goals, and a support system are keys to losing weight and maintaining healthy habits. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
And I'm Art Hughes.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for News from the Boo, and then at 6 o'clock, it's The Underground. That's followed at 7 by Combined Culture Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy, with rain likely and a low around 40, with a light southeast wind. Today in history, in 1900, Prohibitionist Carrie Nation smashed up the bar at the Carrie Hotel in Wichita, Kansas, causing several $1,000s in damage and landing her in jail. The quote of the day is from Dorothy Parker through Tom Waits, though Tom Waits is famous for saying it, "I would rather have a bottle in front of me than a frontal lobotomy."
And now we hear a daily newscast from Public News Service.
Welcome to the Public News Service daily newscast for Wednesday, December 27th, 2017. I'm Mary Sherman. Here's a look at what's making news today. The Department of Defense facing a lawsuit over gun background checks. A researcher weighs in on a growing bias against white Americans. And scientists make a case for eating less meat in 2018. Our top story, three large cities filed a federal lawsuit Tuesday against the Department of Defense, arguing that many service members who are disqualified from gun ownership weren't reported to the National Background Check System.
New York City, San Francisco, and Philadelphia said in court papers that the military's broken system for relaying such information helped spur the massacre of 26 people inside a Texas church last month. Local law enforcement officials rely on the FBI's database to conduct background checks on gun permit applications and to monitor purchases. It must be up to date in order to prevent people from wrongly getting guns, according to the attorneys. The number of white Americans who believe they're being discriminated against is rising. How is this affecting the country? Eric Tegedoff explains.
According to a recent poll, 55% of white Americans believe their group experiences racial discrimination. Clara Wilkins, an assistant professor of psychology at Wesleyan University who studies prejudice, says this perception has grown rapidly since Barack Obama was elected president. For many, his election was a sign of racial progress, but Wilkins says a subset of white Americans saw this as upsetting the social order. Somewhat counterintuitively, her research finds people who believe the country is fair and just also are more likely to perceive discrimination against white people in the wake of Obama's election.
For people who think society is fair, they're the ones who sort of tend to think that the order of society where whites have greater access to wealth, power, status, etc., that is legitimate and it's fair and it's not based in bias. And so if you reject those beliefs, you think that it's not fair, then those are the people who actually welcome social change.
As Wilkins notes, the reality is that vast inequalities in wealth and electoral representation still exist for racial minorities.
Drug overdose deaths are increasingly rapidly in the U.S., and New Hampshire's near the top of the list.
A report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention shows more than 63,000 drug overdose deaths nationwide in 2016, a 21% increase over 2015. And with 39 deaths per 100,000 residents, the Granite State had the third highest rate of drug fatalities. The sharp increase in abuse of synthetic opioids like fentanyl is a driving force behind the numbers. Jessica Halsey-Nickel, president of the Addiction Policy Forum, says the report confirms what her group is already seeing.
This is getting worse, not better, and we need more resources and tools right now with a sense of urgency to help make sure we address it.
A bill known as the Rescue Act, recently introduced in the state Senate, would allow the governor to declare a public health emergency, releasing money from the state's rainy day fund to combat the opioid epidemic. I'm Andrea Sears reporting.
A Christmas snowstorm dumped a record amount of the white stuff on Erie, PA, and surrounding areas are coping with record amounts of snow. The storm brought 34 inches, a record daily amount, and another 19 inches fell before dawn on Tuesday. Officials are urging people to avoid travel, citing poor visibility and deteriorating conditions. Light bulb, here's an idea. Experts say Californians can save money and energy by choosing LED or CFL bulbs. And starting January 1st, the incandescent bulbs that have been around since Edison's time will be illegal to manufacture in the Golden State.
California is the first state in the nation to implement the new standards laid out in the 2007 energy bill signed by President George W. Bush. Noah Horowitz, senior scientist with the Natural Resources Defense Council, says any bulbs produced for sale in California starting in 2018 will have to produce about 3 times more brightness per watt of energy.
LEDs are a far superior product. They give off the same light that an incandescent does, but it doesn't waste energy. And in addition, LEDs last up to 25 years, where with an incandescent you had to change the bulb almost once a year, which was a real hassle.
Opponents of the phase-out say the new bulbs, which are a bit more expensive, impose an unnecessary cost on businesses and consumers. However, the cost of LEDs has moderated. They used to be as high as $20 per bulb, but are now $2 to $3 apiece when purchased in multi-packs, and they last for decades. So, over the lifetime of each bulb, the user saves $50 to $150. I'm Suzanne Potter.
As the new year approaches, many Americans will focus on what resolutions they'll make to do things differently in 2018. Eric Gladys has one suggestion from researchers.
Climate scientists at the University of California at Davis say one option is to help slow climate change by adopting a low emissions diet. Maya Almaraz, a postdoctoral researcher at the university, says while people may feel helpless when it comes to an issue as large as a warming planet, the data shows that personal decisions really can have a big impact.
We make food choices every day. It's an individual choice, and you may make them based on how you want to look or what you want your health to be, or you can choose to make them based on how you want to impact the planet.
Almara says the single biggest move you can make in terms of diet to reduce methane and carbon pollution is by putting less meat on your plate. Almara says by eating fish instead of steak, you'll produce an eightfold reduction in emissions, and switching to beans or lentils drops your footprint to almost zero. I'm Eric Galatis.
I'm Mary Sherman for Public News Service, member and listener supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
And now, a daily report on climate change from Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. For Hector Daniel Flores Mejia, climate change is personal. His family owns a coffee farm in Honduras. The farm's location was once ideal for growing coffee plants. But climate change is bringing warmer temperatures and more humid conditions. It's leading to more pests and coffee rust, a fungus that attacks the plants.
Our farm is located in high altitude, so the weather wasn't warm before, but as it's getting warmer and warmer, we're seeing more coffee rust in our coffee.
He says there's no easy fix for coffee farmers. Many chemicals used to fight coffee rust are toxic for humans, so farmers often have to uproot the plants and start over again. But even that does not get to the root of the problem, the warming climate.
I think we're going to be facing more problems, more insects, more fungi attacking our coffee and probably destroying our coffee farm.
Mejia does not know what will become of the farm, but his family is not alone. Many farmers across Central America are struggling with coffee rust. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
And now for Labor History in 2 with Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 2011. That was the day the National Labor Relations Board ruled that musicians in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, were employees, not independent contractors. Veteran musicians with the Lancaster Symphony Orchestra attempted to organize a union in 2007. They challenged the dictatorial methods by which musicians were treated. They wanted a contract to spell out the rules for hiring, firing, auditioning, grievance procedures, and more. When it came time to sign union cards, the symphony opposed the election, claiming the musicians were independent contractors. The musicians filed with the Regional Labor Board. After receiving an unfavorable ruling, they turned to the national offices in Washington, D.C. There, the board utilized the common law agency test to determine the musician's status. These questions are to discern how much control workers have over the way they work, whether they are highly skilled, how they're paid, and if they provide their own tools, or in this case, instruments. When more answers tilt toward yes, workers are considered independent contractors. The NLRB determined that though these workers are paid on a 1099 instead of a W-2 form, they are employees because of their working conditions. They concluded that orchestral management exerted a great deal of control. Management determined musicians' dress, their posture and behavior before, during, and after rehearsals and concerts. Management also imposed discipline and firing. Musicians voted to join the Greater Lancaster Federation of Musicians the next spring, but their victory was soon undercut by management's refusal to negotiate a first contract. The musicians filed an unfair labor practice and won. The symphony took the case to a federal appeals court, which settled in the union's favor in the spring of 2016. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
It is, wait for it, 527, which means it's time for Jim Hightower.
This special day got me to thinking about America's spirit of giving. And I don't mean this overdone business of Christmas gifts. I mean our true spirit of giving. Giving of ourselves. Yes, we are a country of rugged individualists. Yet there's also a deep, community-minded streak in each of us. We're a people who believe in the notion that we're all in this together. That we can make our individual lives better by contributing to the common good.
The establishment media pays little attention to grassroots generosity, focusing instead on the occasional showy donation by what it calls philanthropists, big tycoons who give a little piece of their billions to some university or museum in exchange for getting a building named after them. But in my mind, the real philanthropists are the millions of you ordinary folks who have precious little money to give, but consistently give of yourselves and do it without demanding that your name be engraved on a granite wall. My own daddy, rest his soul, was a fine example of this. With half a dozen other guys in Denison, Texas, he started the Little League Baseball program, volunteering to build the park, sponsor and coach the teams, run the squawking PA system, etc., etc. Even after I graduated from Little League, Daddy stayed working at it because his involvement was not merely for his kids, but for all. He felt the same way about being taxed to build a public library in town. I don't recall him ever going in that building, much less checking out a book, but he wanted it to be there for the community, and he was happy to pay his part. Not that he was a do-good liberal, for God's sake. Indeed, he called himself a conservative. This is Jim Hightower saying, my daddy didn't even know he had a political philosophy, but he did, and it's the best I've ever heard. He would often say to me, everybody does better when everybody does better. If only our national leaders in Washington and on Wall Street would begin practicing this true American philosophy.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
According to the BBC, China has been using fake LinkedIn profiles to collect information on German officials and politicians. The German intelligence agency BFV alleges that Chinese intelligence used the job-based networking site to target at least 10,000 Germans in order to possibly recruit them as informants. BFV head Hans-Jörg Maaßen said the accounts reveal China's efforts to subvert top-level German politics. China denied similar allegations of cyber spying in the past and has not responded to the German allegation. The BFV published at least 8 of what they claim are the top active profiles used to contact LinkedIn users. The pages are designed to look enticing to viewers and promote young Chinese business professionals who are non-existent.
The ongoing World Speed Chess Championships will see a new winner. Ukrainian Anna Mercychuk, defending champion in both Rapid, where each player gets 15 minutes per game, and Blitz, where players get only 10 minutes, is boycotting the tournament because of the restrictions the tournament's host, Saudi Arabia, placed on female participants. By law, all women in Saudi Arabia must wear the long abaya and are not allowed to be in public without male accompaniment. Saudi authorities would not change the male companion rule, but were persuaded to allow female chess players to compete in high-necked white blouses and blue or black trousers. Mercychuk and her highly ranked sister Maria said these restrictions were discriminatory. Israel's 7 chess players were denied visas to attend the tournament, but special arrangements were made to provide visas to players from Yemen and Qatar, 2 countries Saudi Arabia is currently engaged in hostilities with.
Japan's Emperor Akihito will be the first emperor in about 200 years to abdicate the chrysanthemum throne. The news was first brought to the public's attention on November 30th, although Emperor Akihito had made his wishes to abdicate known last August for reasons of age and health. Emperor Akihito's abdication will take place on April 30th, 2019, when he will be 85 years old. His elder son, Crown Prince Naruhito, 57, will ascend the throne a day later, May 1st, 2019. The decision was made Friday at a meeting of the Imperial House Council. The meeting included politicians, imperial family members, and judicial officers. Japanese legislation has paved the way for the near-flawless transition. According to Japanese law, a monarch could not step down without new legislation in its current legal framework. The emperor is a revered but ceremonial figure in Japan's constitutional monarchy. It is the oldest patriarchal hereditary monarchy dating back to 14 centuries. The last emperor to abdicate was Emperor Kokaku in 1817 during the later part of the Edo period.
The environmental group Sea Shepherd said fishermen shot down one of its night vision drones in Mexico's Gulf of California. The group has used drones to patrol the Gulf, also known as the Sea of Cortez, to combat illegal fishing and to save the critically endangered yaquita, the world's smallest porpoise. Poachers often go out at night to set nets for totoba, but a phrase that is fish that's prized in China. But vaquitas get caught in totoba nets, and the population has dropped to less than 30. Sea Shepherd has been the target of demonstrations by fishermen in the past, but a spokesman said the Christmas Eve shooting represented a new level of violence. The Mexican government welcomed the patrol effort. It's had a hard time enforcing a ban on gill net fishing because the poachers use fast boats and lead police on long chases.
On December 22nd, Uganda's attack aircraft crossed the Uganda-Congo border to strike Beni territory in eastern Congo's North Kivu province. At the same time, Ugandan troops began firing long-range weapons into Congo from the Ugandan side of the border. KPFA's Ann Garrison spoke to Boniface Musavuli, a native of Beni in political exile in France and author of the book The Massacres of Beni.
Boniface Musavuli, just a few days ago, Uganda promised to keep its army on the Ugandan side of the Congolese border. But now its attack aircraft are dropping bombs on the Congolese side, and its troops are firing long-range weapons across the border. Would you call this an invasion in violation of international law? Even though Uganda says they haven't sent ground troops in yet, and the Congolese army in Beni is collaborating with them in this?
Firstly, this military operation is a violation of the international law. Uganda has already been condemned by the International Court of Justice for assaulting and occupying the Congo between 1998 and 2003. The UN Charter prohibits states from using military force on the territory of a foreign state unless they have the UN mandate or authorization from the government of the state concerned. Until now, there is no Security Council resolution authorizing Uganda to conduct operation in a Congolese territory. Also in Congo, there is no official decision from either the government or parliament authorizing the Ugandan army to conduct operation on Congolese territory. Finally, President Kabila cannot take such a decision because he has been out of the term of his constitutional mandate. The DRC constitution does not allow a president whose term of office has expired to bring in a foreign army on Congolese territory. So Uganda is violating international law.
Uganda makes the unlikely claim that they're hunting down the Islamist ADF militia to make sure it doesn't attack Uganda. They say they especially fear this now because the Islamist militia attacked the UN's Tanzanian Force Intervention Brigade. The Force Intervention Brigade meaning peacekeepers with an unusual offensive mandate, not only to protect civilians, but also to go after the militias, massacring them. What's really going on?
This argument is problematic and violates the principle of international law, which is opposed to the theory of preventive warfare. A state cannot conduct operation on the territory of another state because it suspects only that threat will come from that state. In the specific case of Uganda, we know that the attack on Tanzanian peacekeepers was not carried out by the ADF. Moreover, the ADF no longer exists as a military force since April 2014. The massacres and violence that have been taking place in Beni since 2014 are carried out by certain units of the Congolese army, and the criminals recruited in Rwanda by officers of the Congolese army to cause chaos in Beni. Even when the ADF existed as a military force, they were not attacking Uganda. The Ugandan army operation is therefore not justified by the ADF security threat.
Could you say something about the Tanzanian troops, 14 of whom were killed during the December 7 attack?
The Tanzanian peacekeepers had a particularity. They had earned the confidence of Beni's population for several reasons. They were the most motivated contingent, and the population was more likely to confide in them than Congolese soldiers. It must be kept in mind that most Congolese army units in this part of Congo are led by Rwandan officers who are hated by local population for all their crimes.
So the people of Beni have Rwandan officers in their own army, and now they've got Ugandan attack aircraft overhead, dropping bombs, and Ugandan troops shelling them from across the border. Is this the latest phase of the de facto occupation that began when Rwanda and Uganda invaded Congo in the 1990s?
Thousands of Rwandan soldiers were poured into the ranks of the Congolese army following the Goma Agreement of March 2009. Since 2013, thousands of Rwandan civilians have been sent to Beni, where they are occupying the lands where ADF were conducting their activities. Uganda is currently in conflict with Rwanda and certainly does not welcome this massive influx of Rwandans, soldiers and civilians into this part of the Congolese bordering its territory.
Earlier this week, MONUSCO's public information director responded to my inquiry and said that when the UN Security Council renewed the Tanzanian troops' mandate, they, quote, stressed the importance of neutralizing the Allied Democratic Forces, ADF, among other armed groups, unquote. Now, the UN News Report, the UN's Radio Okapi, MONUSCO Chief Maman S. Hirikua, and all the mainstream media blame the ADF for the attack on the Tanzanian peacekeepers. Your response?
The UN has been talking about alleged ADF for almost 3 years now because it knows that the real ADF no longer exists. ADF leader Jamil Mukulu was arrested in Tanzania in April 2015 and he has been in prison in Uganda since May 2015. All the area formerly controlled by the ADF have already been recovered by the army and MONUSCO. The attack on the peacekeepers was carried out by a force of several hundred fighters wearing FARDC uniforms in the area under control of army. The ADF, even when they were active, could not carry out such a large-scale operation. Moreover, the number of ADF who survived the 2014 operation is estimated at only 100 individuals on the spot, scattered throughout the bush without coordination or supplies. Who can believe that individuals in such a situation could mobilize several hundred of fighters and attack a position of peacekeepers for more than 3 hours?
And that was Boniface Musavuli, native of Beni territory in the Democratic Republic of the Congo's North Kivu province. The Congo crisis is now one of the greatest humanitarian emergencies in the world and the most underreported. An average of 5,500 people a day flee violence and insecurity, even more than in Iraq, Syria, or Yemen. In Berkeley for Pacifica, KPFA and Afrobeat Radio, I'm Ann Garrison.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael. The producer is Kyle Qureshi. Our engineer tonight is David Kesters. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelcelis Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. And you can also find us on Facebook or on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR in Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Voices from the Edge with Joanne Hardesty. At 9, Press Watch with Teresa Mitchell. At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10, at 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Between the Covers, Denise Kowalczyk talks to author Deborah Reed about her new novel, The Days When Birds Come Back. And at 11:30, Words with Pictures, SW Concert talks to Frederick Wiseman, one of the pioneers of the documentary film movement known as direct cinema. KABU keeps you informed and involved in the community. If you would like to become a member, go to KABU.fm and click on Donate.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KABU with news from your community radio station.
Hello and welcome to News from the Boo. This is your weekly update to find out everything that's happening here in and around KABU. I'm Delphine Crescenzo, your host this evening. I'm super happy because I'm joined by Mike Crenshaw, who is usually your host too.
Hey, what's up, Dale?
Nothing much except you leaving. I'm sad.
Yeah, I'm sad and I'm happy.
And I understand why.
Yeah, and you know, the last time we were in here, I was thinking about it, was when you and
Gil
and me talked and did News from the Boo when I was coming in.
Mm-hmm. Back in August.
Yeah.
And that's it. You'll be moving on. So January 8th will be your last day.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for stepping in the interim and supporting us, the community, myself in particular, with your leadership. It's been an honor working with you.
Thank you, Dale.
Yeah. And so, folks, if you are curious, I'm going to be your full-time station manager starting January 8th.
Let's make 2018 the best year for KABU.
Ever. We're on it. 50
yes.
years. So, but Mike, you have so much going on, and I know you're still going to be involved with our community, so we're going to talk about that. But first, let's talk about Earthbound, your newest album.
For sure.
Talk a little bit about the content, what it's about, and then where can people hear it?
Okay, so right now, if you go to my SoundCloud, Mike Crenshaw, MICCRENSHAW. There's a couple of singles that are on the album. If you go to Amazon Music, if you go to iTunes, the single Earthbound has been already released late in 2017. And the album itself is going to be available digitally on January 1st, 2018. There's going to be a record release party at the Jack London Review, which is downstairs from the Rialto downtown, on January 27th. So I say all that to say that the album is called Earthbound. The single is Earthbound, and there are 9 songs on the record. And the reason I called the album Earthbound and named it after the first single, which has already been released, is because I wanted to address socio-political, economic, and ecological issues of our time through a song that basically talks about what the moment that history has led us to, with exploitation of not only ourselves but of many, many species, which are facing extinction, which impact our future and our ability as a human